This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. About 10 years ago, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, found itself in the middle of a media firestorm. The incoming freshman class, like other classes before them, was given a summer reading assignment, a translation of select passages from the Quran. The year was 2002, 1 year after 9/11. So the choice sparked a controversy and led to attacks on UNC by conservative media and politicians, and even a lawsuit against the university filed by a Virginia-based family values group. Reporters from all the big news outlets, even the fake ones, camped outside the campus to cover the scandal.
Can you tell me about this tradition called Al-Nakhter?
Well, I've only been here for about 6 weeks or so, so I haven't heard of all the traditions.
Well, it's a tradition where students stay up late, drink a lot of coffee because they have an exam the next day. It's called Al-Nakhter.
You mean an all-nighter?
I'm sorry, my accent is terrible.
Chapel Hill's foot soldiers also have links to camps throughout the state. But their spiritual leader has even grander designs.
There are 250,000 members of the Al-Umni spread all over the world. It's quite a network.
Yes, that is correct. That many alumni.
Why, thank you very much, Caliph Kirkpatrick.
No, not a caliph, no.
I'm sorry, the Grand Mufti Kirkpatrick of UNC.
There are no muftis here.
We'll see about that. UNC religion scholar Carl Ernst watched that clip from The Daily Show, and he also witnessed a very serious coverage of the so-called summer reading scandal. And although the reading assignment culminated in a calm, intellectual conversation about the religious text among freshmen, Carl says anxiety about the Quran still exists. In response to that concern, he's written a book called How to Read the Quran, A New Guide with Select Translations. Carl Ernst is the William R. Keenan Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies at UNC Chapel Hill and my guest this hour on the program. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much, Frank.
2002, the pain of 9/11, of course, still fresh with Americans, which can explain at least some reaction, why some eyebrows went up at UNC. That was 2002. Why publish this guide to the Quran 10 years later?
Well, I think it's still a case that there is a tremendous anxiety about the mere existence of the Quran, both in secular circles and conservative religious ones. We've seen that in recent controversies, including a pastor in Florida who threatened to burn the Quran last year, and allegations that the Quran is responsible for violence and various other accusations. So I think the problem is people don't have a way to understand how to read the text, and that's what I'm attempting to provide.
Let's tell us about it. How is the Quran structured?
Well, very briefly, it is divided into 114 chapters called surahs, which are actually organized in decreasing length. In other words, more or less, we can see this progress. Number two is the longest of them, and the ones at the very end are the very shortest. Now, oddly enough, from the stranger's point of view, this doesn't actually correspond to the order in which they were delivered during the lifetime of the Prophet Muhammad. So, in fact, the ones at the beginning of the Quran were the last to be delivered, and this makes it very difficult to read if you start on page one.
And maybe we should have started there. What is the Quran?
Well, the Quran is a word which means recitation. It's a little bit different than the word Bible, which means book. And so there's a kind of an oral aspect of the delivery of a text in the verbal form of the Arabic language. It is traditionally assigned to the period of the lifetime of the Prophet Muhammad, which means around 610 to 632 of the Common Era. And Muslims regard this as the word of God that was delivered through the Prophet.
And then written down in Arabic.
That's right.
And these surahs that you talk about, 114 of them, how much of it is history, how much of it is parable, or is that part of the way the book is structured?
The approach I'm taking is to look at the scholarship on the delivery of the Quran, and we divide this up into two periods, the period when the Prophet was at Mecca, which was 610 to 622, and then when he moved to Medina from 622 until 632. And we can further break down the Meccan period into three separate phases, which are really according to the style of the text. It starts off with very, very short poetic lines, which have a high emphasis on the apocalypse and the end times. And over time, it becomes more prosaic and it tends to address more contemporary events and legislation. So the nature of the Quran changes over time.
Can you give us a sample?
Yes. This is one of the early Meccan surahs, and I'm choosing a short piece which takes the form of what is called a rider oath. That is, it invokes some entities of the cosmos, which might be winds or stars or angels, but they also look like horses. And it might remind you of the feeling of a group of Arab tribesmen who are raiding an encampment. But the interesting thing is it sort of connects that ecology of the Arab world to the apocalypse and the end times, because it's about the Day of Judgment. And it's only six lines long. This is the opening of Surah 77. By the sent ones tightly maned, by the stormers in storm, by the scatterers of scattering, by the dividers of division, by the casters of reminder, in excuse and in warning, the very thing you are promised is surely happening. And that is the judgment day it's talking about.
Professor Carl Ernst reading from his new book, How to Read the Quran. And of course, that is one of the difficulties for all of us if you try to read a translation of the Quran. Sometimes the text itself is a little off-putting and obscure. It seems difficult.
It's challenging for the first-time reader. And just to give you one other example of stylistic difficulty, it shifts its point of view dramatically sometimes from one line to the next, shifting from I to you to we to he. And it's almost as if we have a Shakespearean play, but without the names of the actors in the margins, or the roles in the margins. So you need to have a little help to get into it.
Is this – would this help come from your own cultural background? If you were raised in a Muslim tradition, all of this would make sense to you? Or does that vary from place to place in the Islamic world?
Well, it does. but I think it's also important to say that the Quran was addressed to an audience that was very knowledgeable about the Bible and other religious texts that were current in the ancient world. And so if one has the ability to put together the Quran with its references to biblical figures, then you suddenly realize that it's part of an ongoing tradition, and it's not really this exotic text that's way out there on the margins.
And as you point out in your book, it makes reference to those – to biblical texts, but doesn't really recite any of those stories.
No, that's what's interesting. The Quran really presumes that the audience is quite familiar with these stories, and so it says things like, and in the story of Moses and Pharaoh, and it sort of assumes that everybody knows what's going on there. It even makes rather what you might think of obscure references. For instance, when the Israelites were trying to enter the Promised Land, basically most people failed to do so except for Joshua and Caleb. And so the Quran just refers to the two who entered the Promised Land and assumes that everyone knows who that is.
You also say that one of the mistakes people make here in the West in trying to understand the Quran is that somehow you can parachute into a particular page and say, well, this – and read a passage, mm-hmm. and think you know what Islam teaches about this particular topic.
The same kind of mistake would apply to the Bible. I mean, to simply select texts at random, particularly lines that sound alarming, is – essentially, not just lazy, but it could be dishonest as a way of representing a text. What's another great discovery that I found when I went into the literature on current scholarship is that the Quran, like many other ancient texts, has a characteristic that's called ring composition or symmetrical structure, which means that rather than being a linear composition, it's like an onion with many layers, and the beginning and the end of a surah refer to each other. And then what you learn is that the center is where the meaning is located, and that allows you to figure out which are the most crucial verses.
Is there that kind of complementarity? I think you can find that in at least one of the Gospels too, where the first and the last line somehow are complementary, the second, the penultimate and the second line, and then the meaning is
– Exactly. It's true in a number of New Testament passages as well as in Numbers and Leviticus in the Old Testament. And Homer's Iliad is, for instance, an incredibly tight symmetrical structure. So this is a way in which a lot of ancient works were constructed. Modern readers sometimes pick them up and say, wait a minute, this is confused and disorganized because it doesn't correspond to my linear way of thinking.
But it was a form of literature. The Prophet Muhammad was famously not literate, and yet this book comes from the revelation of Allah to the Prophet. What is the scholarship around the actual construction of the Quran, and over what period of time do secular scholars think?
Well, this is a challenging area, and there are, frankly, different accounts in the Arabic historical sources that are not all compatible about exactly when the text was codified and put together. I think we can say that it did come together under the supervision of the early Arab Empire when, as you might expect, an attempt to standardize the source went along with the centralization of power. Now, there have been a few outliers, some sort of eccentric revisionist attempts to argue that the Quran is not really in Arabic at all and everyone has misunderstood it for 1,400 years, or that it's basically a Christian document that no one understood until I came along. And these are sort of – I mean, we're used to the Indiana Jones and Da Vinci Code approach where supposedly a document can be found that will overturn the history of Christianity. But we take those with a grain of salt. When people hear this about the Quran, there's greater interest in sort of debunking the text just because of the suspicion that's attached to it. But most of the scholars are actually convinced that it's probably within 20, 30 years after the time of the prophet that it became solidified in the form that we know it.
And in writing.
Yes. Although when I would say in writing, we should clarify that the Arabic script is in its old forms only has the consonants. And so the vowels could be read in different ways. And so there are different ways of reading the text, although frankly it's more stable really than the New Testament, which has a lot of divergence in the manuscripts.
Another great mistake you say people make in reading the Quran is assuming that having read the Quran you understand all there is to know about Islam, about the Muslim faith.
That's right, Frank. The thing is that we have a lot of history that's taken place between now and the time the Quran first appeared. And there was a development of vast intellectual disciplines, including Islamic law, philosophy, mysticism, ethics, politics, and so forth, and many different environments where, frankly, people speak different languages, they have different ethnic groups and cultures. And so it's sort of like looking at the Bible and trying to predict this year's election. You simply can't produce everything out of the ancient text. It's really important, but it doesn't explain everything by any means.
How did you go about translating the Quran?
Well, I've been reading the Quran in Arabic for over 30 years since my graduate school days. And basically, I work with the best dictionary sources and Arabic literary background. And also, I've pulling on the work of some of the great German scholars who, frankly, haven't really been studied very much because most people aren't reading German these days. But I compare also other translations into English and French and Spanish and German to see what scholars have done with it. And then I try to hit a voice that works in contemporary English that is sometimes informal but which conveys emotional power. And I'm hoping that succeeds.
It also raises questions about how the Quran is interpreted in various Muslim countries because there is a kind of high form of Arabic, and mm-hmm. I'm assuming that's the official text. But then there are all these vernaculars, and not everybody in the Muslim world is conversant in or literate in that high Arabic.
Well, of course. In fact, perhaps only less than 20% of Muslims actually speak Arabic as their native language. So people are actually relying upon traditional commentaries. And there's a great deal of interesting material in there. But and I think that's worthy of attention. And we need to have more study about the history of interpretation. And there are many different interpretations. But what I'm trying to do is to look at the text as it appeared to its first audience before it became a canonical text. And that way, I think you can kind of replicate or imagine the experience of how people picked up the vocabulary, understood the images, and became part of a community of knowledge. And that, I think, will give readers a chance to actually read this text rather than simply being baffled by it.
Mainstream criticisms of the Quran, of course, involve how the text addresses gender roles and other faiths, particularly the Jews. How do you approach those questions in your interpretations?
Well, many people approach the Quran in a subject-oriented fashion, assuming that it has a single consistent point of view that can be decided very easily. I don't actually make that assumption. And it actually changes its perspective over time on a number of issues. For instance, in the treatment of alcohol, which in early verses is not really a problem at all. And later people try to iron this out with a device they call abrogation, which assumes that the latest verses would overturn earlier ones. Now, that's kind of a risky thing to do because do you really want to say that God was changing his mind all the time? And also, from a literary perspective, I'm uncomfortable with the notion that you're going to not read certain texts because some later ones seem to be contradicting it. So, but in any case, yeah, I think the Quran does refer to a society that was that had its misogynistic or patriarchal elements, no question about it. And those are part of the discourse of language in the Quran. And people like any other religious tradition have to deal with the discrepancies between these early societies and what's happened very recently in changing gender roles. So I'm not an apologist for the Quran in any sense. But as far as relations with other religions are concerned, I think that a fresh reading of the Quran that doesn't read in contemporary conflicts shows that the Quran is actually far more pluralistic than people are going to expect because the verses about multiple religions being paths to God occupy the central places in the structure of the surahs.
Carl Ernst, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Frank.
Carl Ernst, William R. Keenan Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies at UNC Chapel Hill. His latest book is How to Read the Quran. It's available now from UNC Press. That's the State of Things for today. Thanks for listening. You can find us archived at stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Amber Nimix and Alex Granados. Robin Copley is the technical director. Managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas. And Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.